Let's talk history. I'm Bob Garrett, Lansing Community College's archivist. I invite you to join me on a journey as I delve into the college's past and ponder its meaning. Here on Tales from the LCC Archives. Hello, everybody. I'm Bob Garrett, here again for Tales from the LCC Archives. And with me is Ben Ackley. Tell me about your position here at LCC, Ben.
Yeah, I'm the communications specialist here at LCC's downtown library. So I do some event programming, I do some designing, I'm all over the place at the library and spreading flyers around campus.
Okay, great. And I've invited you here today to talk about trivia. And I was looking through the lookout and I found some old trivia questions from 1969. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me, they're all pop culture questions, so I thought it would be fun to kind of go over some of them and maybe talk about changes in pop culture since 1969 and what people remember and maybe what people don't remember.
Yeah, there are a lot of stumpers in here for the modern reader.
I think you could say that, yes. Okay, so if we start out with one, for example. Now, here's one that I had not heard before. Who was the teacher on Ding Dong School? Have you ever heard of Ding Dong School?
Who is the teacher? What is that?
What is that? The answer it says is Miss Francis, but I think it was interesting to me that in 1969, this is something that they thought a number of people would know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the architecture of television was really different too. If you think about what kids watch today versus what kids watched back then, I mean, it was people in very obvious TV studios and a set of kids on bleachers, you know, like the Bozo Show, stuff like that.
Right.
It's
I guess what's kind of fun, I mean, I consider myself pretty well up on even older pop culture, you know, and this is something that just went by. I don't even remember my parents ever talking about this. You know, my parents would talk about Howdy Doody and Pinky Lee and some other kids, and Roy Rogers and stuff that they watched as kids. But I don't even remember this.
Right, and I'm so far disconnected from any of it that it's like...
Well, that's what, I mean, you're younger than I am, so I thought maybe you would be a little bit more in... Yeah, you're probably more in tune with pop culture today than I am.
Maybe a little. But, maybe, I mean, all of this stuff, too, like, if you're thinking about old television like that, a lot of it wasn't preserved at all.
No.
Just because of the way that it was, like, it was all done live, and you have kinescopes of some stuff when they would just shoot a screen in the studio, basically. But if you don't have that for a lot of stuff pre, like, the 60s, we just don't have any evidence that it really ever existed.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think a lot of things about, one of the questions is what survived, what do people still remember? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's because something was really popular, you're more likely to remember it.
Yeah.
I mean, there are shows from that era that even if you've never seen I Love Lucy, you've probably heard of it. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen I Love Lucy?
I've not seen it, but I've definitely heard of it.
Okay, so it's out there. So there's something like that that survives. And sometimes it depends on what survives is because what's accessible, what's there. And I was sort of thinking about TV shows from my youth. I mean, one of the very popular ones, have you ever heard of WKRP in Cincinnati?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when I was in high school, people were always would talk about that show. People would watch it, but nobody's seen it anymore. And part of the reason nobody's seen it is because of the rights, because they used to put a lot of music in there. And you know all of this, it sounds like, yeah. Mm. And I think that's sad because it was a good show. And I mean, a lot of people my age are very nostalgic about it. We'll look back on it and really fondly, but nobody can see it. No one's going to remember it. And I used to think about, there's a friend of mine who's really into silent movies.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a big fan of Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
And he told me something one time that really stuck with me. You had the three big comedians of the silent era were Harold Lloyd, Buster Keaton, and Charlie Chaplin. And who do you think was the most, he told me, who do you think was the most popular in their era in the 20s of those three?
Right. If you're looking at it from today, you'd say Charlie Chaplin for sure.
Right. It was actually Harold Lloyd.
Right.
And my friend was telling me that the thing with Harold Lloyd is he didn't, because he had apparently the copyright on his movies or something for a long time. But anyway, he didn't want them shown.
Mm.
They were not shown for many, many years. And as a result of that, for decades, I mean, they're all publicly available now. You can find them on YouTube.
Yeah.
But for many years, Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, those old movies were shown. Harold Lloyd's were not. So over the time, subsequent generations started gravitating more toward Keaton and Chaplin.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, right. You think about that with the rights issues and like we were talking about already, sort of technological limitations. You watch that happen over and over again, where stuff becomes inaccessible or disappears just because the framework wasn't there to save it. Like with early silent movies, a ton of those early silent movies are totally missing or destroyed. There are no copies of any of them. And it's the same with early TV. And then it's the same again with the early internet. There are tons of things that were on the early internet that are just totally gone now.
Yeah.
Totally inaccessible. Or even if they are kind of accessible, they're pretty broken.
Right.
And that's, I think, just sort of a hurdle. Like in archives, you're always kind of catching up.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's like, okay, so now we have this new technology. How do we save this? And not only how do we save it, but how do we keep it, if it's something interactive like a web page, how do we keep it interactive? Or if it's some old film, how do we keep this, you know, when they were doing silent films originally, the music was all being made in the room with the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, how do you most faithfully recreate that? Lots of really interesting problems come up with this kind of ephemeral pop culture stuff that wasn't made to be saved forever.
Oh, right. Absolutely. Well, and web pages, archivists are already debating the best way to save those. And that, you know, is a big ongoing debate.
Yeah. And things just get obsolete. And I mean, in the internet age, things get obsolete so much more quickly.
They do. Well, and that brings me to another thing. This occurred to me, actually, just as an aside. We were talking about WKRP in Cincinnati occurred to me as this big show from my youth that I can't see anymore. And yet, every Thanksgiving, when I look on Facebook, I see this whole meme about, oh my God, I thought turkeys could fly, which is from that show.
Mm.
I remember watching that episode when it first aired. And now I'm guessing that a lot of people your age have probably never seen that episode, but they know that meme. They know that joke.
Yeah. Huh.
And it's strange when you think about that, because, I mean, that wasn't even my favorite episode of the show. I don't think it was funny. But, I mean, it's just, why has that survived and not a lot of the into meme? I guess it's memeable, but one thing is because it's Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
It's tied to the holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of holiday stuff, I think you get that.
Yeah. It's interesting how those just little kind of tendrils lead out of different big properties like that. I mean, you can go all the way back with that if you want. All the stuff that... all the terms that Shakespeare coined that we use every day and we don't even think about attributed to him or where they originally came from or anything like that. Like, that's a pretty extreme example relative to a meme on Facebook, but it's essentially the same thing.
You know, it is. It is. Well, and Shakespeare and then the movie Casablanca, you know, the first time I saw that, I remember, oh my God, that's where that comes from. That's where, you know, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship and blah, blah, you know, all that is from Casablanca, but a lot of people that have never seen those movies know those terms.
Right. The stuff sort of just infects the culture eventually.
Right. Mm.
And we were talking before this, too, about, like, the monoculture, how much that has changed in the last 20 or 30 years.
Right.
Like, once the internet came around, especially now with streaming, it's like we're not all sitting down to watch WKRP in Cincinnati on a Thursday night, you know?
No.
Like, if you're doing it at all, you're doing it on your own, and maybe you have a friend who watches it, and that's who you're going to talk to about it.
Well, that's the thing. I remember the days when you talk about, quote-unquote, water cooler shows.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody watched this show the night before, and then the next day at work, supposedly, according to this, they gather around the water cooler and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or when I was in school, we'd all, you know, in high school, we'd all talk about it in study hall or whatever, what have you. Is there anything like that today? I mean, there are shows that are popular.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there are still kind of vestigial parts of that. Like, there will be things that get popular. There'll be big popcorn movies every summer, whatever. But it's much less of a big deal than it once was. Like, if you're looking at the stuff that everyone knows from a given year, I assume that list is probably a lot shorter. And stuff just moves so fast now that it's really easy to miss things. Like, when it comes to, you know, whenever there's some popular show out, I almost always miss it until it's 6 months too late and no one's talking about it anymore because you just do it all on your own time.
Well, there's so much content. I was thinking the last TV show that I watched, because I'm a big spy fan. I like a lot of spy movies and spy books. So I just got around, like, last month to watching Killing Eve, which has been off the air. I think the last episode, I looked it up, aired in 2022. So it's first aired in 2018, just ended in 2022. But I'm just watching it now. And it seems like nobody are, is anybody even talking about it now? I guess it's the part thing is, a lot, there are all these shows, but nobody's watching them at the same time.
Right.
Number one. And then the other thing, there's niches. Like I said, I like all, a lot of spy shows and spy stuff. There's a lot of that out there, but I get to it in my own time. So now I'm watching things like 4 years after they went off the air. So it's not like everybody watched a lot of the same shows the night before and then goes and talks about them.
Right. And, you know, you probably, if you wanted to get really grand with it, could tie that and just sort of the modern media landscape into like the loneliness epidemic and how everyone feels kind of isolated.
Right.
Because there is just less common stuff that we can all talk about together.
Right.
I think that there's probably something to be said there. I don't know that I'm the guy to say it, but it does feel a little bit isolating, but it is, it's a give and take too, you know, like there are lots of shows from the 60s and 70s and 80s that were great shows, but only ran for two seasons, didn't make it to syndication and then just get forgot about.
Right.
And at least now those shorter shows have a place to live and hopefully actually be seen. Well, you can see stuff get popular again after it came out, which is very different than what happened most of the time with movies and music and TV shows back in the day. Like, one of my favorite recent movies is this movie Dinner in America, which was shot here in Michigan. It was shot mostly in Detroit. It's like a punk rock rom-com. And it came out in 2020, like right before the pandemic. Okay. Nobody saw it because it came out right before the pandemic. And then it got really big on TikTok like last year or the year before. And now a ton of people know about it and it's become like sort of a cult favorite, which is something that was very rare back in the day and is a lot easier to manufacture now, I guess, through social media.
I guess that's true. Well, that's an interesting thing because there's more access to a lot of this older material than ever before. So, I mean, a lot of it is out there. You know, I'll every once in a while, I'll see what older, what classic movies are on HBO Max because they got the Turner Classics. So that stuff is there. But you kind of have to know to look for it. I mean, I think you're always going to get people that are interested.
Yeah.
You're always going to get people that are interested in older pop culture. But how do you sift through all of that, through all that content?
Right. Well, it is a lot of work, and it is something you have to kind of dedicate yourself to. That's a frustration that I have with a lot of people my age, just because I like so much old music and stuff, and I like a lot of things that I feel like, oh, this should be common knowledge, or more people should know about X, Y, or Z thing that I really like. But the algorithm doesn't serve it to people, and people don't really know where to look. It's, you know, like we talk about in so many areas, so much information that it's really easy to get lost in if you're not good at parsing that stuff.
Well, I'm going to go back to the Lookout trivia questions again, because one thing I thought about, obviously we were talking about access being a big deal, but also just kind of popularity.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I Love Lucy is an example from something in the 50s that people remember.
Right.
And why do people remember I Love Lucy? And again, part of that is access. But what, let's look some of this older stuff and think, what do we remember? What don't we remember?
Yeah.
And then maybe think about what might we remember now. But I, here's one. Who played Superman on the radio?
Couldn't tell you.
Couldn't tell you. Right. Well, it's kind of an interesting one. The answer is Bud Collier. And some people out there who like us know a little bit of older pop culture, it goes way back, would not know that he also hosted some game shows like later on in the television era. But here's an interesting, you've never heard of Bud Collier, but you know who Superman is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing. So Superman has survived, but nobody's seen that radio show. Do you remember who played, do you know who played Superman in the 1950s on that TV show?
I know, I just recently watched an old Unsolved Mysteries episode where they talked about him, and I still can't remember the actor's name.
I guess that says something.
Yeah.
But I guess the character of Superman has survived.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is. This established, I mean, well, that's just become such a popular thing now, IP.
Right.
Making movies out of things that exist already, making TV shows out of properties that have existed already. It's not a new concept, but it's become like the bread and butter for movie studios especially.
Right.
And I don't know. People have been trying to solve that for a long time. Is Hollywood bankrupt of ideas or anything? I don't think it's that extreme. I think that it's just a easy source for stuff. It's sort of a proven market already, right? The superhero thing especially. We saw how big that became in the last decade.
Well, I guess the superhero thing, because I think about that survives some of these other questions. Like there's one about naming the seven dwarfs from the Disney movie.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Snow White is a fairy tale that goes back centuries.
Yeah.
But the names of those dwarfs are from that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And people remember that. Probably.
Yeah.
I'm guessing a lot of people. Could you name the seven dwarfs?
No.
Okay. All right.
I'm not dedicated enough to Disney for that. But I really, I mean, that movie is just a really great example of like how a piece of art can stand the test of time. Like a lot of this is chance and things being in the right place at the right time. But something like that specifically, I think, is just an example of such great and creative work that it like can't be forgotten for a really long time. Right. Like Metropolis or something, you know.
That's true. The Disney movie was the first full-length animated film, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and it pioneering so many new processes. That's all of that early Disney stuff is really great, and I think has stuck around because they were being so inventive at that time.
Well, and that movie was from 1937, if memory serves, and it's in color.
Yes.
You know, which was also unusual at that time. And Metropolis, yes, also very groundbreaking at the time. I mean, I watched that on YouTube one time because I thought I had to see it, and it's worth seeing for anybody out there who hasn't.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, so a lot of stuff, like, there's artistic merit there, I think. That can be a big reason that stuff sticks around.
Okay, artistic merit.
Not always.
Well, I guess that's a question. Is there anything from there that has stuck around from older eras that you think didn't deserve to?
I mean...
Well, I mean, people talk about Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah, that's an interesting example because I'm a big bad movie aficionado. I really like cheesy sci-fi and horror from that era. And it's honestly, Plan 9 is bad, but it's not particularly outstanding relative to a lot of other stuff I've seen from that time and relative to other stuff I've seen from that director.
Right.
He definitely has worse, and I have seen worse from that era too. So it, you know, a lot of that stuff too can be ascribed to just like a certain book. There were a few different books around the same time when like B movies were becoming popular again in the 80s that wrote about Plan 9. And I think that's a really big reason for the popularity of that.
Something that comes around. And I guess that's another thing, is something that was forgotten and is also remembered later. The movie It's a Wonderful Life, for example, was not a big hit when it came out. You know, it was forgotten for a long time. And somehow it fell in the public domain, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And then all the TV stations started running it.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, oh, my God, this is a great movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's my favorite Christmas movie.
I love that movie.
Yeah.
Makes me cry every time.
That, yes.
And that, yeah, I mean, that similar thing happened with Night of the Living Dead, too, where Night of the Living Dead just accidentally fell into the public domain, and then it showed up over and over again on home video because it was so cheap to do, and it showed up on TV all the time and became a really big deal. Is a super groundbreaking movie. Is the reason that we have zombies in the popular culture the way they are today.
Right.
But just so, public domain.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, artistic merit does have a role.
Yeah.
I think often.
I think so.
And actually, we're talking about bad movies, but even in that case, I think you can make the argument the really bad movies are the ones that are just boring.
Yes.
If it's bad, but you laugh at it,
Yeah, there is a big dip there in the middle of all the stuff that it's just like, okay, I get it.
Right. But I think, artistic merit matters. Think about what's popular now. What do you think the next generation or the generation that will at least have heard of?
Hmm. That's so hard to say, especially because like the landscape of art and the way that we consume it and the way that we interface with it has changed so much in the last 20 or 30 years.
Right.
It's really, really difficult to say what it's going to look like 30 years from now, because it seemed like streaming was the big thing forever. I know there's been a really big groundswell of people my age interested in owning things. Right. And physical media and having DVDs and Blu-rays and MP3 players and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, physical media, though, there's also the question of how long that's going to last.
Right, if you think about optical discs.
Actually, here's a story for you.
Yeah.
I was, for last year, toward the end of last year, because sometimes when I go to the gym, I'll watch a TV show on my phone. I'll watch something on my phone while I'm working out. And I started watching old episodes of MASH.
Yeah.
And I was watching those on my phone. Well, come January 1st, all of a sudden it wasn't on Hulu anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hell, I had four more seasons to go. It's like I felt like I have to watch the rest of this. So I found a DVD set, and I look at it, and it was interesting that something I hadn't noticed was on Hulu, but then when I went back and looked, I mean, I was watching it on my phone, but then when I looked back and looked at my laptop, I saw it, was that this white surgical gowns that these doctors were wearing had like a pink tint to it.
Oh.
Yeah, and it was really strange. And I'm like, what the heck? Is this a bad transfer? But I talked to somebody who knows something more about these things. And yeah, that can happen, you know, to color film after a while if they haven't remastered or whatever.
Oh.
So I guess future generations will never watch MASH and realize that those hospital gowns aren't supposed to have a pink tint to them. But you're talking about preservation issues, and this is a show that's, you know, we're talking from 50 years ago, which,
yeah.
I mean, okay, 50 years ago, half a century. But still, there's a, I mean, that's a, in some ways, it's almost the technology. The more stuff it adds, the more preservation issues you have in a way, too. Black and white is always easier to preserve than color.
Yeah. Well, and you think, too, like looking at these trivia questions, one of my favorite parts here is this, and I think the first one you sent me, there's a part at the bottom that just says remember. And then it's a list of a bunch of significant musicians from like a decade or so prior.
Okay.
Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans and Chuck Willis and the Five Satins and Huey Smith and the Cadillacs and a bunch of like really great R&B and rock groups. And I think a lot, I'm very into 50s music. That's
okay.
A lot of what I listen to is music of the 50s.
Yeah.
And I think a lot about when I am 55, a lot of what I listen to is going to be 100 years old.
Well, you know, when I was young, I was this kid who knew all this old stuff. And now I'm an older guy that knows really old stuff. But yeah, my parents grew up in the 50s and did a lot of that too. And actually, one thing we haven't even touched on too much yet is what that culture says about the time, which is also a whole nother thing. But I was looking at the songs you were talking about.
Yeah.
Johnny Horton, for example, have you heard like Sink the Bismarck and Battle of New Orleans?
Yes.
As an historian, I find Johnny Horton kind of fascinating because it's that post-World War II thing where everything was the great white man of history, and he's
right.
And it's all military. All his songs are about military victories, and the U.S. is number one. And
right. And you notice that that's not the kind of stuff that they play in American Graffiti.
No, I actually haven't seen American Graffiti. I should one of these
but
days.
But they're hitting the cool rock and roll hits of the time there. They're not playing that stuff. Well, and it does say a lot about, like, it seems like the popular culture isn't even necessarily always what defines a certain era. It's usually a countercultural thing that defines a certain era. Like if you think about the 50s, rock and roll is like the thing that really defines it. And that was countercultural. It was popular amongst young people. It wasn't popular amongst the general population.
There is a book I would recommend to anybody interested in music history. I forget the author's name. It's called How the Beatles Destroyed Rock and Roll.
Mm-hmm.
It's not actually about the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's a buzzy title. It probably sells more copies, but it's really about the history of pop music, and it goes from the 1890s and ragtime all the way up to basically about 1970 and how it's changed. And it goes into things like technological innovations, things we talk about, how the jukebox changed how we listen to music, and how many musicians were out of work now because it was so much easier for these establishments to just get a jukebox.
Definitely.
right? And how that went with the top 40 hits and how, you know, and it was just, it's a fascinating book. And again, I wish I remembered the author's name, but I would recommend that to anybody.
Yeah. And I mean, that does go to show kind of how much of this is manufactured. Right. You think about, like, Alan Freed is mentioned in these trivia questions, and he was sort of a king of payola. making sure that the right songs ended up, you know, whatever they thought the right songs were, ended up being big hits. And I think that that's a tradition that carries on very strong today. But it's, you know, I guess if I had, like, any sort of thinking about pop culture and thinking about what it looks like today and what it looks like for the future, you can kind of make your own, really. Like, there's a lot of digging to do, but everything is out there and accessible now. It's not like 30 or 40 years ago where you had to go to the record store and dig through bins and hopefully find something cool. Now it's really easy to find whatever it is that totally speaks to you.
Yeah. And
you can do that with the power of the internet.
This has been Bob Garrett with Tales from the LCC Archives. To listen to this episode and other episodes on demand, visit lccconnect.org. Please join me next time on Tales from the LCC Archives as we explore, share, and preserve the tales that make Lansing Community College what it is today. Once again, this is Bob Garrett reminding you, look at the past to understand the present.
Featuring the faculty, staff, students, and others that helped to make Lansing's premier college what it is today. LCC Connect, Mid-Michigan's connection to Lansing Community College. To find out more about our featured programs or to listen on demand, visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
The stage is alive and well at Lansing Community College. Each year, the downtown campus comes to life with more than 30 performances at Dart Auditorium, the Black Box Theater, and LCC's Outdoor Amphitheater. These productions are more than entertainment. They're part of the learning experience. Students in LCC's Performing Arts program gain hands-on experience, both on stage and behind the scenes, developing confidence, creativity, and collaboration. From powerful plays to lively concerts, LCC's performances celebrate local talent and the vibrant spirit of the arts in our community. All performances are free. Find out what's next at lcc.edu/showinfo.
Hi, I'm Lisa Alexander, and I host a show called Who's That Star on LCC Connect. This show is all about an inside look at the LCC community, where you get a chance to meet our faculty and staff, plus learn about their passion projects at work and at home. You can catch Who's That Star here on LCC Connect or listen anytime at lccconnect.org.
A single ember that escapes from a wildfire can travel over a mile, carrying a world of trouble. It can land, ignite, and destroy your home and community. You can't control where that ember will land, only what happens before it does. With simple things like clearing areas around buildings, knowing community safe zones, and being prepared for wildfires, you could keep this from turning into this. Your home is better protected from wildfire when your whole community is prepared. Visit fireadapted.org for more tips on how to get started adapting your home and community to wildfires. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Studies have shown that learning a new language can positively impact your concentration, memory, and overall communication skills. The Adult Enrichment Program offers the opportunity to learn fundamental Spanish speaking, reading, and writing skills through cultural activities and in-person conversations. No prior experience necessary. Visit lcc.edu/keeplearning for more information.
LCC. Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
This is Bob Myers from the Historical Society of Michigan with a Michigan history moment. It was called the Black Legion. A Midwestern offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan, it demonstrated an even greater propensity for violence. During the 1930s, the Black Legion launched a wave of arson, bombings, beatings, and executions. Like the KKK, the Black Legion opposed African Americans, Catholics, and Jews. It also fought against labor unions, which its members saw as a part of a communist takeover of America. It was founded in the 1920s by William Shepherd, a doctor from Bel Air, Ohio. In 1931, the Legion established a Michigan chapter in Highland Park. Most Black Legion members were poorly educated, Anglo-Saxon males, many of whom had moved to Michigan from the Deep South to find factory work. In its nighttime initiation rites, members had to pledge loyalty to the organization and to keep its secrets under penalty of death. During the Legion's peak years, 1933 to 1936, its members burned down the homes of Union tradesmen. In Detroit, they bombed the hall of the Ukrainian Educational Society and bookstore. A long list of murders included George Marchuk, the secretary of the Auto Workers Union in Lincoln Park, who was found shot to death in a vacant lot, and John Bilek, an organizer for the American Federation of Labor. In May 1936, a group of Black Legionnaires murdered Charles Poole, a young organizer for the Works Progress Administration, who was a Catholic married to a Protestant woman. Legion members believed, wrongly, that Poole beat his wife. Public outrage led to an investigation by Wayne County Prosecutor Duncan McCrae. McCrae brought in Black Legionnaires for questioning. Trigger man Dayton Dean confessed after learning that Poole had never beaten his wife, and he implicated many other Black Legionnaires. Dean also revealed a plot to murder Arthur Kingsley, publisher of a community newspaper in Highland Park, and a scheme to inject typhoid germs into dairy products circulated through Jewish markets. McCrae won murder convictions for 11 Black Legion members, including Dayton Dean, who eventually died in prison. More trials sent 37 additional Legionnaires to prison. The convictions left the Black Legion in disarray. The Legion's national commander, Virgil Effinger, tried and failed to form a new organization. Finally, the Black Legion's campaign of terror in Michigan came to an end. This Michigan History Moment was brought to you by MichiganHistoryMagazine.org.
Keep connected with LCC Connect at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
K-12 Operations at Lansing Community College has been a proud collaborator of the Lansing Promise Scholarship since 2012. The Lansing Promise Scholarship offers graduating high school seniors who live within the Lansing School District and attend a high school within district boundaries an opportunity to attend LCC. Since its inception, over 1,000 enrolled students have saved over $2 million, earning over 400 degrees and certificates, as well as 30,000 credits at LCC. For more information on the Lansing Promise Scholarship, please visit lcc.edu/hope.
Thank you for listening to LCC Connect. I'm Paul Schwartz, and I host a show called The Safety Plan. The Safety Plan is about the latest cyber scams and how to avoid them. You can catch The Safety Plan here on LCC Connect or listen anytime at lccconnect.org.
Work, school, grocery shopping, doctor's appointments, the gym. to the airport to pick up loved ones, to the kids' soccer games, piano lessons, out for movie night, to hear your favorite band in the city, over to Grandma and Grandpa's house, and on last year's amazing road trip. Your vehicle takes you so many places. Protect it. When you leave your vehicle, remember to always take your keys or key fob with you and lock the doors. If you suspect auto theft, contact the National Insurance Crime Bureau at 1-800-TEL-NICB. That's 1-800-TEL-NICB, or visit our website at www.nicb.org. A public service message from the National Insurance Crime Bureau.
A 7-week job training opportunity is now enrolling, and many can participate tuition-free. Those who have graduated from high school within the last 5 years can attend the Electrical Control Technician Boot Camp at no cost, thanks to grants from the Michigan Department of Economic Development. Those interested in the Electrical Control Technician Boot Camp provided by the LCC Job Training Center can learn more at lcc.edu/JTC.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Hello, and welcome to Leading the Way, Women in Higher Education, a podcast dedicated to celebrating, supporting, and advancing women in higher education across Michigan. Hello, I'm Dr. Cynthia Rooker, and today we're shining a spotlight on one of the most prestigious honors in our state's academic community, the Distinguished Woman in Higher Education Leadership Award, presented annually by the Michigan ACE Women's Network. This award recognizes Michigan women who have provided outstanding leadership to women in their institutions, in their profession, and in society at large. It celebrates those who have gone beyond their formal roles to advocate for women and serve as catalysts for change. Okay, Marlana, can you please share the origin story of the Distinguished Women in Higher Education Leadership Award and what inspired Michigan ACE to create this recognition?
Sure. I'll start out by just sharing a little bit about myself. So I'm Marlana Landero. I currently am at the University of Michigan in Michigan Medicine in our community program in a unit called Adolescent Health Initiative. And so we teach providers across the U.S. how to be adolescent friendly. Previous to that, I was 20 plus years in public safety, law enforcement, specifically handling our student programs and all what that brought to the University of Michigan under that public safety umbrella. And I'm also on faculty at the School of Social Work at the University of Michigan Ann Arbor campus and Schoolcraft College. So, a lot of extensive 20 plus years in higher education period. And more recently in Michigan AC, I am currently the DWA, which we're here to talk about today, chair. So to answer your question, when we think about, like you said, the origin of it, the award was created to recognize and honor those individuals who have distinguished themselves year after year after year over the course of years by providing outstanding leadership to women in their institutions, in their profession, and just the society at large. The award is designed to recognize work that's on the behalf of women in higher education that is actually beyond the scope of their formal staff position or faculty job responsibilities. Some of those things would include, mentoring others to enhance their leadership skills in higher education, also teaching those to increase responsibility roles. What does that look like? How do you manage it? Implementing and planning programs, conducting research, also presentations, also just advocacy overall. I think what's important to realize is with that advocacy, it's about the individual, it's about the institution, it's about policy changes, it's about knowing current climate and actually saying, hey, something needs to be done about that. It's also helping guide those through their educational pathways. Sometimes there's people that we all need when we do the work out here. And so I think some of these women, are part of that. And that's why the award was put together to say, hey, we need to highlight these women who are doing the work in higher ed. And its creation actually spoke to current climate always. So since the late 70s into present, it's been Michigan AC has been something that has led the focus for higher education. So again, women leaders doing the work, continuing to do the work today. They continue to do it day after day, creating history, laying the foundation for that, and actually opening up conversations on college campuses across the board where women leaders are actually able to showcase their impact. And so the award does that in a formalized way.
Oh, fantastic. There's a lot involved in that. So what makes this award so unique among leaders honored in higher education? Like, how does it reflect Michigan ACE's values and mission?
Sure. So I talked about before just thinking about how there is a unique intersection in higher education. It's a very unique place that there's a lot happening. So what makes this award unique is that it highlights the work being done outside of the day-to-day, right? It showcases the passion of each of the awardees, the work that they're doing, how they're doing it, inspiring others to do it. It's like a call to action for others to get involved or to learn. And I think year after year, we've been able to do that through the DWA award, is actually bringing forward women leaders who are doing the work that's, again, beyond their day-to-day, but saying like, hey, even though this is beyond your day-to-day, it's important to realize that the work has to be done and they have a unique perspective and passion to get it done. I think what makes it unique also is that it's an honor at our annual conference. So it's in front of others in higher education. It's in front of your institutional leader and other invited guests. And then with the Michigan ACE vision, mission, and values, it's just a reminder of the work, like I said, that women leaders are doing beyond their day-to-day, highlighting their involvement in the community, the differences that they're making to empower themselves, to empower others, to empower their communities, their institutions, and then also just empowering career success and bringing a greater voice to whatever their passion is. So that includes quality leadership, teamwork, mentorship, inclusive participation in the community and leadership in general. And then many times it's about building a network and having colleagues that you can reach out to that may hold positions and be able to just have a conversation like we're doing here, just for overall support many times. So that's a uniqueness.
Fantastic. Well, you mentioned a lot of things in reference to the contributions, leadership, and qualities in as far as looking at them as nominees, the number of nominees that you probably have, I would imagine, to go through. Can you walk us through that nomination selection process, if possible, and just kind of explain how the candidates are identified and what role do the institutional leaders play in that process?
Sure. Yeah, so just touching a little bit on what are we looking for in the selection process and what is the selection process? Things we're considering is, do they have a philosophy of helping women that goes beyond their job duties? Do they themselves have a reputation on their campus or in the community that brings that together? Meaning, the community is benefiting because of them being represented and just their actions, period. Do they have a positive impact on women in leadership? Like I said, it goes beyond just what they're doing on their campus, but actually in the community and with people. Publications, presentations are part of that. Are they providing new information on women and leadership and higher ed? Also thinking about, are they creating events or programs that benefit women across the board in higher education? And then just overall, are they presenting evidence of advancement of women in general by breaking even gender barriers, right? Thinking about what roles are they serving? What are they bringing forward? Specifically thinking about non-traditional or groundbreaking career roles, if we were to use that terminology. And then just thinking a little bit about the selection process. We do focus on providing about 3 awards every year. We at minimum, we would have people from a 2-year institution and a 4-year institution. So normally that's what we would have. So we do distinguish between the 2 and the 4-year institutions just to make sure that we know that sometimes resources may not be as rich in a 2-year versus a 4-year, and it may look different. So we want to make sure we're highlighting those opportunities for both of those institutions. And then also walking through it a little bit more, we receive the nominations from presidents or chief campus executives who are part of Michigan ACE. So I put out a call to action as the chair, and then we ask for campus leaders to submit nominations. Formally, the nominations are done through a formalized process that includes a Michigan ACE Award Committee. The committee is made up mostly of me as the chair, and then other previous past state chairs, and then those that have historically been vetted in the award, maybe previous recipients. But all of these people are part of the Michigan ACE Executive Board overall. As I mentioned before, those leaders that are submitting the nominations, once we get those nominations through a document that I received, that is basically a criteria of a leader, the university leader, laying out, here's the reason, here's why I believe, and laying out the why. And then another reference that also adds to, this is why I'm putting forth this nomination. With all those things coming together and the resume or CV of the nominee, we go through that, and the committee go through the process of reading those, and then in a formalized way, also once we get back all that information together as a team, then we make a decision, and then we put forth a name from institutions with the nominations to the board for voting. And just as a plug, we're looking for those nominations to go out later on this year, and to then get them back by the beginning of the year. So all of those would come back to me as the chair.
Excellent. Well, yeah. Glad that you took the opportunity to put that plug in for you. That's fantastic.
Well, yeah, great. I put it on people's minds earlier, because we know sometimes you want to nominate people, you want to put together packets, but sometimes we just don't have the time to do it. And I think that's another big one too, which thank you to you all at Lansing Community College, and having the, you know, forethought to say, hey, let's get this on people's minds. So there's a lot of people doing the good work out here, but they also need someone to write the nomination letter.
That obviously takes some time. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, can you tell us, do you have a story or an example of a past honoree whose work truly embodied the spirit of this award? And what impact did their recognition have?
Sure. Asking that question, it actually brings me to two of our 2025 honorees, because so different but so similar. So Sister Nancy Damaraz from Madonna University and Sophia Brewer, who's a librarian from Grand Rapids Community College, they both shared in their acceptance speeches during the conference that they didn't even see themselves as leaders worthy of this award. Because of all the differences that they made on their campuses and local communities, they just considered themselves just being themselves. But no matter what was happening on their campus or current climate, they both found ways to have creative problem solving through engagement and dialogue, acts of service. And they didn't even know that they were actually modeling servant leadership. So those two stand out to me as earlier this year during the conference, as those that just shows the heart of the award, that just shows that people are just being themselves, but them just being themselves is so impactful, and they themselves don't even know how impactful it is. And so it's just nice to see and hear individuals who maybe may not have been highlighted in other places because people may not put focus on what they're doing. But through this opportunity, those people are able to actually receive the recognition that they should.
Fantastic. That's a great example. I do remember seeing them up on the stage, and that was beautiful to see. So how about looking ahead? Tell us, how do you see this award evolving, like to continue recognizing groundbreaking leaderships in Michigan's colleges and universities?
Yeah, so I am in a position where I am the chair. This will be my first year leading it. So it's an adjustment time, too, where we've been able to say, okay, here's how we plan. Here's what happened before. And we were able to tweak it going into the 2025 conference. And now that we've actually been through it with the 2025 conference going into the 2026, we now have some ideas and opportunities that we believe will just, you know, continue to make the actual process and the actual time spent during the luncheon at the annual conference just worthy. I say that because we all know things have to evolve. And so I think this is an example of what we're doing right now, that with Michigan ACE membership increasing, getting the interest out there, and then, you know, great foundations being set by Lansing Community College, you know, being the conference host and getting the word out on platforms like this and other ways, I think we're going to just continue to evolve into what are the needs of those that are in higher ed, and how do we evolve based on current climate? How do we evolve based on the feedback from prior recipients? And then just like I said, women in higher ed. And so we're open to any and all ideas in the world around us, and it's changing. And we know that higher ed is something that we have to make sure that we're maintaining and that everyone can thrive in that space. But again, trying to highlight those that have historically made a difference and continue to make a difference. So I think we're going to have to just continuously to make sure that we're paying attention to what current climate is and we're adjusting. Some of those things, I use the terminology, are just as easy as technology. I mean, it's just that simple that we actually open up more opportunity and get the word out by just leveraging technology to do it, like I said before, on platforms this way. And then also the ease. And you also heard me mention about people have to take time out to write the nomination. If you have a cumbersome process, that makes it harder. Or if it's not evolving with the times, that makes it harder. So I think just taking a hard look at some of those things and evolving it that way. And I think that will then also open up the opportunity for others to do more work.
Absolutely. And once you move any of those barriers or obstacles and make it easier for people is always, mm-hmm. always much better. Wow. Well, thank you so much, Marlena, for sharing your insights, helping us understand the significance of the Distinguished Women in Higher Education Award. This honor not only celebrates individual achievement, it uplifts the collective progress of women in academia and reminds us that the power of advocacy, mentorship, and leadership. If you'd like to learn more about Michigan ACE or nominate someone for this award, visit miacenetwork.org. Thanks for tuning in to Leading the Way, Women in Higher Education. Until next time, keep leading, keep learning, and keep lifting others along the way. For more information, please visit our website at lcc.edu/network. Thanks for tuning in to Leading the Way, Women in Higher Education. To listen to this episode and others, visit lccconnect.com. Until next time, keep leading, keep learning, and keep lifting others along the way.
This is WLNZ, Lansing. You're listening to LCC Connect Weekly, a radio program from Lansing Community College's podcast network, LCC Connect. Powered by LCC staff, faculty, students, and community volunteers, LCC Connect brings you the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. and the spirit of Mid-Michigan. We feature more than 30 podcasts that explore education, culture, community, and our connection to the world. To listen on demand, find us at lccconnect.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.